The University of Notre Dame sparks controversy by appointing an openly pro-abortion professor to head a major department. Retired Notre Dame professor Father Bill Miscampbell and president of Notre Dame Right to Life Anna Kelly weigh in. And attorney and free speech advocate Eva Vlaardingerbroek joins us with her take on the rise of censorship in Europe and why she's banned from the UK. U.S.-Iran nuclear talks are back on despite growing tensions between the two countries. Dr. Waleed Faraz and Ghazal Sharmad are here with analysis. And a special preview of Bernadette the musical. It's the life I live. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over as we celebrate our 30th year. We've got an important show for you this evening. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo or at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. The University of Notre Dame in the U.S. has found itself in a troubling predicament. The administration has appointed Susan Osterman. She's an openly pro-abortion professor to direct its Liu Institute for Asian Studies. The backlash has been swift and severe. Two fellows have resigned from the program. Students are up in arms. Joining me now for reaction, Father Bill Miscampbell, professor emeritus of history at Notre Dame and a consistent voice for the university's Catholic mission, also with us. Anna Kelly, a Notre Dame senior and president of Notre Dame Right to Life. Father, I want to start with you. You wrote an op-ed decrying this appointment. Tell us exactly what makes Susan Osterman's appointment so problematic.
Raymond, she has an extensive record of pro-abortion advocacy. This is not someone who is mildly pro-choice and keeps sort of her personal views to herself. She has been a strident advocate for abortion and also a fierce critic of crisis pregnancy centers. She has a particular animosity to them. She has also been a consultant to the Population Council, which, as we know, has such a terrible human rights record, in fact, in Asia. And so all of these combine to make this simply an appointment that goes against Notre Dame's professed commitment to be in support of the sanctity of human life. So it's just a terrible appointment. I find it hard to explain how it could even have come about, but it has come about and it must now be rescinded.
Father, you've taught at Notre Dame for decades. You're a priest of the Holy Cross, which this is the order that runs Notre Dame. You've seen administrations come and go. Do you view this as a misstep or a willful abandonment of Notre Dame's Catholic identity?
Look, Raymond, I'm not on the inside as to how this appointment came about, but there must have been awareness on the part of the Dean, Mary Gallagher, of the Keough School of Global Affairs, and the Provost, John McGreevy, of Susan Osterman's extensive pro-abortion record. Now, I don't know what would have motivated them to proceed ahead with an appointment in light of that record, but it does not speak well for either of them that they proceeded ahead ignoring this long record of pro-abortion activity. So I see it perhaps as something more than a misstep, I regret to say.
Father Miscampbell, two fellows have now resigned from the Asian Studies program rather than work under Osterman's leadership. One said, and I quote, "Continued formal association with a unit of the university led by such a person, to me, is simply unconscionable." That's extraordinary language from academics. What does that tell you about how serious this breach is?
I think those two fellows, one a professor in the law school, one a retired professor of theology and a wonderful expert theologian of Buddhism and so forth, both of them realized the significance of the leadership of the Liu Institute for Asian Studies. The fact that they would appoint someone with these views to an Asian Studies Institute tells me that these folks recognize clearly it is simply beyond the pale. And they've made it clear in the statements that they have given with their resignations. So, Raymond, I think we face a situation here where the fellows of the university have to step in and encourage our president, Father Dowd, to direct the provost to rescind this appointment. Failure to do so will put at risk Notre Dame's whole reputation as a serious Catholic university committed to the sanctity of human life.
Father, the university defended the appointment in The Observer, the independent Notre Dame paper. They claim that academic freedom and diversity of viewpoint justify hiring somebody whose public stance contradicts Catholic teaching on the sanctity of life. How would you respond to that? Does it?
Look, there is no way in which the university's claim is that Professor Osterman would be able to separate off her personal views from her leadership of the Lew Institute. But given the range of population issues that beset contemporary Asia, there is no way that a person holding her perspective can effectively lead the Lew Institute. The Lew Institute should be a vehicle criticizing the human rights abuses that have occurred in Asia. And Susan Osterman, with her association with the Population Council, simply cannot do that. The university is engaged in a sort of dissimulation, and it's rather sad to see. The communications people should take a close look at themselves.
Yeah. Father, I will come back to you in a moment. I want to bring in President of Notre Dame Right to Life, Anna Kelly. You're a senior, Anna, at Notre Dame, an adoptee from China. Now, when you learned that the university had appointed a publicly pro-abortion advocate to lead the Asian Studies Department, what went through your mind?
To be honest with you, Raymond, my own testimony wasn't the first thing that came to mind. I was concerned about the identity of Our Lady's University and what this meant for the culture. But as I started researching and as I started discussing more with professors and students, I thought that my voice could hold weight in this conversation, because the fact of the matter is, this is a reality. It's not abstract ideology that she's dealing with. Abortion affects lives everywhere. And she worked for the Population Council, which publicly supported this population control in China and affected millions of families, including my own life. I mean, I am so blessed to be given this platform to speak on, and I am so grateful for the life I've been given, but I could have easily been one of the children that the Population Council sought to end the life of.
Yeah. Anna, you issued a very powerful statement this week on the subject. You called this appointment a betrayal. I want to read some of your words. We'll put it on the screen. As a Catholic adoptee from China, I take personal offense at this appointment. I'm so blessed to have escaped the fate that Professor Osterman's work has inflicted on so many innocent Chinese lives. Because I've been given the gift of life, I'm choosing to speak out with my own testimony to bring attention to the real-life consequences that her ideology promotes. Anna, tell our viewers, as someone whose very life was threatened by these coercive population policies in China, why did this decision by your beloved university feel so personal to you? And are your fellow students, do they understand the real-world implications of this?
I've had a lot of conversations with fellow students, and they really are upset by this appointment. I think my friends specifically, who understand that I was blessed to be given life, they feel personal conviction in this issue as well. I just really want to emphasize again the blessings that I've been given and the fact that this policy threatened my own life, and this is why I feel like I have to speak out. These lives are people. Each person is made in the image of God. We are unique beings from conception. And these policies hurt and tear down and they dehumanize lives. These lives are across the globe, but they mean as much as your neighbor, as us right now speaking. it's so important to take a stand on these issues, because we aren't dealing with ideas and hypotheticals. These are lives affected. Millions of babies were aborted. And I was lucky enough to be given the chance of life. And I was left on the gates of an orphanage. And I had a letter from my birth mother saying she wished me a good life. And it's for her that I thank to be given this opportunity to speak.
Beautiful, Anna. Before I let you go, do you think your generation of Notre Dame students will ultimately reclaim the university's Catholic mission? I mean, we saw that beautiful mass. They built an ice cathedral. 2,000 plus came out in the cold. Clearly, there's something still attached to the Catholic faith that runs deep in the student body, if not the administration.
Yes, I think that the Catholic culture, like any institution, has its weaknesses and its issues. But overall, my personal experience has been phenomenal. I have made such wonderful connections, students, administrators, and it's all grounded in the faith. One particular institution, the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture, has spoken out on life issues and has been a great support to me personally, to the Notre Dame Right to Life. As you mentioned, the ICE Chapel that was built was a testimony that the culture of life is not dead on campus. It's very much alive. No. Our OCIA programs is one of the largest in the countries. And I'm so blessed to be a part of this university. And I don't think we can just write off the Catholic culture as not existing in Our Lady's University, because there are so many witnesses to the faith.
Yeah, no, it can't be confined to a logo. You know, that won't do it at Our Lady's University. Father, I'm going to give you the last word. Your reaction to what you heard from Anna just now and other students and faculty whom I know you're in touch with. And are you encouraged by this? And do you think the administration is listening?
Well, firstly, let me say it's wonderful students like Anna Kelly who are going to help sustain and develop and enrich the Catholic mission of Notre Dame. The students may be in some ways the strongest element, and we need to get the administration to recognize what the students can see with their own eyes, that this appointment is such a contradiction to all the good that is going on here. And I hope and pray that administrators are watching this program and saw Anna's testimony here tonight, Raymond. I thank you for giving us the chance to speak on this matter. Hopefully, perhaps next week you'll be able to report that something of a positive nature has occurred with regard to this appointment.
That's a great cliffhanger, Father, and we will be watching for resolution here. Father Bill Miss Campbell, Anna Kelly, thank you both for being here. Thank you for your time. And I also want to ask the audience's prayers for one of the members of the Notre Dame family, a pal of mine, the legendary coach Lou Holtz, who entered hospice care recently. Please pray for the coach and his family. Thank you both.
Thank you, Raymond. Thank you.
Thank you. God bless.
She's become one of Europe's most outspoken voices on immigration, national sovereignty, and free speech, positions that have earned her both passionate support and fierce opposition. Last year, the UK government took the extraordinary step of banning her from entering England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. She's also an attorney, a Catholic convert, and a new mom. Please welcome to the program Ava Vilardinga-Brooke. Thank you so much for being with us, Ava. Look, I need to get into this question of the stated reason for your travel ban from the UK is that your presence might incite hatred or threaten public order. But you've never called for violence. You've made arguments, controversial ones at times, certainly in Western Europe, but arguments nonetheless. Take me through how this ban came about and what does it tell you and all of us about free speech in Europe today?
Sure. Yeah, this happened just a couple of weeks ago. I was sitting here in my living room with my husband and our baby, and I checked my email. And out of the blue, I saw that I had received an email from the UK government. And it was this really simple outlay, you know, just a couple of sentences saying that my ETA, which is like the travel authorization that Europeans need to travel to the UK, had been revoked. Mm-hmm. And the reason they stated for that was that I am, quote, not conducive to the public good.
Huh. Wow. That's the grounds. Mm-hmm. I mean, now an intellectual, so intellectual curiosity and intellectual arguments are now security threats? Is that basically what they're saying?
Apparently, and moreover, apparently criticizing the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is something that can get you banned from the country, because that is really the only reason I see as to why this happened. For your audience, I had no imminent plans of going to the UK. I didn't buy like plane tickets or anything. This was a travel authorization that I had gotten back in September when I last went there. But what I did do was criticize Keir Starmer on X just 3 days before I received that email revoking my ETA. So I got an effective travel ban for criticizing the Prime Minister.
Now look, you're an attorney by training. What does it say about the rule of law when governments can unilaterally ban political commentators on social media without any real due process? Or apparently, I mean, they didn't contact you in advance, did they?
They did not contact me. And also another thing that they said in the email was that their decision was not open to appeal. So to answer your question, what that says about the rule of law, it says that the rule of law is dead in Europe. It says that it doesn't exist, right? Because if you get a notification like that out of the blue, you have no ability, no means to defend yourself or to say, hey, this is wrong. I don't have a criminal record. I didn't commit a crime. But they just said, no, you know, we are telling you now you are not conducive to the public good, even though there are thousands of immigrants illegally entering the United Kingdom every day. Now, mind you, I'm not doing that. You know, I'm just a tourist. I'm just someone who wants to come and give their opinion or see my friends. I got converted to Catholicism in the United Kingdom. So I have a couple of really dear friends there. And now I'm no longer able to go because I say the wrong things, apparently. And so that is the state of Europe right now. They either throw you in jail or they make sure that you can't enter the country. That's what happens in the United Kingdom if you go against the grain.
Let's talk about the issue that did put you in the crosshairs. You alluded to it a moment ago, immigration. I mean, you've argued that mass immigration from the third world has destabilized Europe, eroded social cohesion, and led to all these spikes in violent crimes. Now, I've read some of your critics who call that inflammatory, even racist. You would say what?
It's the truth. And I don't care what they then call it, but it's the truth. And anyone with two eyes can see that it's true. Everyone who lives here, you know, apart from maybe people living in ivory towers or in areas where there are no immigrants, everyone who lives in the real world knows that it's true. So I don't care what label they give me or what they call me. I will continue speaking the truth about what I see happening to this beautiful continent of ours because it's being destroyed. Yeah. You know, we see churches burning down every week here in Europe. And that's not a coincidence. That didn't happen for hundreds of years. And suddenly now in our time, they're burning down faster than I can count. That's not, you know, that's a consequence of what has been done to our continent. It's a consequence of the open borders. And that's just one example. But this is affecting people's everyday lives.
Yeah. Ava, you recently shared a gut-wrenching story on X about a Somali migrant who got a mere 3.5 years in prison after attempted rape and murder of a Dutch 20-year-old victim. He only got 3.5 years, despite the man having an 8-page criminal record. And by the way, he's just limited time in prison because I guess they had some doubt about whether the chokehold he used was strong or long enough to kill the victim. I mean, Ava, we see these scenarios playing out again and again in Europe. Your thoughts on these judges and the latitude they grant the guilty, the criminally guilty, when they're illegal immigrants or immigrants?
Well, the governments and the legal system seem to be working hand in hand, right? It's the governments that let them in. So you can break the law coming here, right? That's not being punished. In fact, it's rewarded because people get to stay, people get free housing, people get free healthcare, and they're able to just roam around, even awaiting whether they are going to get their asylum approved or not. That's the current state, you know, in Europe. And that's one side. Then you have the judges, the legal system, that once these people come here and commit crimes, which happens in a very, very disproportional, you know, at a very disproportional rate to, let's say, the native population. I mean, the migrants are very, very much overrepresented in crime, especially when it comes to sexual crimes. Then the judges go ahead and they say, oh no, but you know, this person is maybe not, we can't hold them accountable because they are traumatized because they come from a war scene, or they make something up about their mental state. And then what ends up happening is these immigrants who rape, kill, and assault the native population, they just don't get any real prison time, and they definitely do not get deported, which is what you would want, right? Because I mean, even if they were to get life in prison here, which hardly ever happens, but even if they do, that means that the native population has to pay for them for the rest of their lives, you know, rotting in jail, that is, but still. And that cannot go on this way. So these judges are complicit, I would say, in letting this happen.
Eva, why do you think the European elected officials and the intelligentsia, why are they so against protecting themselves and their culture? Is this some holdover from World War II? What is it?
I think so. I think that this is a holdover from World War II. I think that after the Second World War, the universities, the intelligentsia, as you said, the neo-Marxists that occupy our universities, let's face it, but also our legal systems, and of course these institutions such as the European Union, they have categorized, I suppose, or have given evil one face and one face only: the patriarchy, conservative, white men, usually. I mean, women too, they'll make an exception for me, I suppose. But so after that, after the World War, once you, they've decided that that is the only evil that exists in this world, I think. And so they really don't see, or they refuse to see, the difference between a Nazi and a conservative Christian. To them, it's all the same. And that's the way that they treat us.
I want to talk about what's happening here in the United States. I know you've been following it from afar. As you know, millions and millions of illegal crossings happened under the Biden administration, sanctuary cities that refused to cooperate with federal law enforcement. I want to get your take on Minneapolis, where you're seeing these mass protests, even violence against ICE and Border Patrol, as they attempt to enforce established immigration law. We've seen, you know, deadly protests. As a Catholic, as a recent convert, what do you make of the assertion by some, even bishops, that if one doesn't support open borders or nearly unregulated migration, then one is a bad Catholic?
Yeah, I think that that is a lie, and at least a deceitful story that we really should put to an end. I mean, as a Catholic, of course, we can be charitable. Nobody's saying that we cannot allow some immigration or that we cannot help those in need. That is, of course, a Catholic ideal. That is a Catholic value. That is what Christianity always has, you know, that's what our legal system reflects. That doesn't mean, however, that when you come here illegally, which is what happens the majority of the time, and you break our laws, that we have to sit by and watch that happen. These law enforcers, ICE, they are doing their job. They are enforcing the law. I think it's a disgrace the way that they are being treated. And I wish actually that here in Europe, we would have our version of ICE, and that they would actually do what they should be doing, which is to indeed send back home the people who come here illegally and who do not belong in these countries and who actively fight everything that we stand for, both in America and here in Europe. So I can only say that I'm appalled by what I see coming from America, but I didn't expect anything else from the left, I suppose.
Well, you mentioned something earlier that certainly resonated with me, this idea of preserving the Western European culture, heritage, and what you're really talking about is the Christian heritage of Europe, that it seems to me is in great danger of rupture and just erasure. Well, I mean, as you mentioned, in France, churches are burning like they're just tinder waiting to go up. I've never seen anything like it in the desecration of these churches. Clearly, there's something happening there. Why is Europe and its leaders afraid to acknowledge that and take steps to stop it? It is their heritage too.
I don't think they're afraid to acknowledge it. I think they honestly don't care. I mean, the churches that are being burned down in France that we see, that's, you know, that's a physical thing in, unfolding in front of our eyes. So I think that's, that is powerful imagery that should wake people up to something else, something invisible, which is the agenda that is being carried out here to erode Christianity. I mean, if I just may remind your audience, for example, the European Union, when they talk about European culture, identity, and history, which they barely do, but if they do, they never mention Christianity. They actively removed it from their documents. They talk about the Enlightenment, but Christianity is never mentioned, which is, so it's, they are actively eroding and erasing Christianity here in Europe because it threatens their agenda, because these people see themselves as God.
There are a couple of countries where that isn't happening, in Poland and Hungary. Now, I know they're under intense pressure by the EU. Can they escape that pressure? Those are really two countries that are saying, look, we will limit, which the church teaches as a good thing, the country which will limit who comes in and create an orderly process to do so and who stays out.
Of course, yes. Well, we have elections coming up in Hungary very soon in April. And I would really ask your audience to pray for Viktor Orban, because he, especially Hungary, is the last bastion, I would say, of the true Europe, of Christianity, of freedom. He openly speaks about it. He openly defends it. He has been able to defend his borders at a very high price. The Hungarians pay €1 million in fines every single day to the European Union. If Orban falls, we are in deep trouble here. So I really would request prayers for him and for the Hungarians.
Eva Vardingerbroek, thank you so much for being here. What a joy to speak with you, and we'll have you back soon.
Thank you so much. I would love to be back on soon.
And this week over on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down with comedy great Kevin James for a freewheeling conversation about comedy, faith, marriage, fatherhood, and how laughter still connects us in fractured times. We also talked about his new romantic comedy, a touching one, called Solo Mio. I know you co-wrote this story, Solo Mio, with the Canine Brothers, who I'm talking to in a minute. Tell me what did you want to convey? This is a story of a guy left at the altar in Italy, and he has to put his life back together.
It was intentional to start rock bottom. You know, this guy is, you know, by design, he's not only left at the altar, he's left at the altar and not in the States where he's around his groomsmen or his buddies and his family. He's an island. He's gone. He's in Rome by himself and has to go on his honeymoon because he paid for the package and he's got nowhere to go. No, he doesn't know anybody. And it's these two people, like, this is the strongest, these Jonathan Rumi and Kim Coates, these guys he comes across that they don't know him. They don't know each other. And what they do is, by the way, they're on their honeymoon, you know, and they kind of neglect their wives to see this brother who's down and reach out and pick him up and put him on their back. And they carry me through this journey. And it's beautiful in that way.
Yeah.
It's like, they know, you know, they're helping out.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Kevin James is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. Those drop every Wednesday. And be sure to subscribe. I don't want you to miss an episode. And it's free. And of course, be on the lookout for Friday's installment of The Prayerful Posse. We'll get into this Notre Dame controversy and we'll talk about the Pope's overtures to Cuba and the United States and where that might go. Go to Arroyo Grande Show wherever you get your podcasts. Tensions due to economic unrest within Iran continue to simmer. While diplomatic talks between the U.S. and Iran are set to resume this week, are more U.S. military strikes imminent? And will the people of Iran rise up and demand regime change? With analysis, I'm joined by Middle East policy analyst Dr. Waleed Fares and human rights advocate Jazelle Sharmad. Thank you both for being here. And you are both co-hosts of the War and Freedom podcast. Thanks so much. These diplomatic talks are set to resume this week with Steve Witkoff in Oman. Talks the Trump administration say are meant to establish guardrails with Iran. But given Iran's track record, Waleed, the recent attacks on our forces, their nuclear acceleration, the continued arming of Hamas, Hezbollah, why should anyone believe these talks will produce anything?
Raymond, as you and I have discussed this forever, obviously my answer is the conclusion here is I do not trust this regime, the Islamic regime in Iran. What they're trying to do right now is basically to gain time, as much time as they can, because according to our intelligence, they believe the Iranian regime or the Islamic regime in Iran believe that something domestic is going to happen in the United States in the next few months so that the president and the cabinet will be very busy. So they are doing everything they can. First of all, they said we're ready to discuss everything, including the domestic issues. Now they're saying we're not. We're only discussing nuclear. And then now they're changing location from one country to another. It's the regular Khomeinist tactic, gaining time. You got it, Raymond.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think the goal of this talk is from the U.S. perspective? What do they really want to get out of this?
From the U.S. perspective, basically from the president's perspective, is that the regime will start accepting all these conditions. I mean, with regard to nuclear, there is no nuclear. I just messaged this on Twitter. There is no nuclear anymore before the next 5 years. But let's assume they want to cancel the capability of Tehran in terms of long-range missiles. That's the ICBM. Mm-hmm. They want to see that regime stopping funding of the various militias in the region. But no words on behalf of the regime regarding the domestic situation. They are ready to pay time and everything, but they cannot accept the connection between the free world and the people of Iran because that would bring their end.
Ghazal, you have said repeatedly that the Iranian people are ready for regime change. We've seen the protests, we've seen the fires, the women refusing to wear the hijabs, the strikes. Will the U.S. attempt to negotiate with the regime over the heads of the Iranian people? And what do ordinary Iranians think of these attempts at diplomacy?
Thank you, Raymond, for having me here. Let me first clarify the stance of the Iranian people. The Iranian people don't see this regime as their regime. They see it as a foreign occupation. That's why they're not talking about regime change. They're talking about liberation. This is comparable historically with France under Nazi occupation. The French under Nazi occupation were not seeing the German Nazis as their own government, the Vichy government or anything. So we had to understand that the Hitler regime was an expansionist, genocidal regime expanding all over Europe and becoming a threat to us. That's how the Iranian people see this regime. So they will never accept this regime. And even if there is anybody out there that wants to negotiate with this crumbling regime, the Iranian people will not allow that. Right now in Iran, there's martial law. That means this regime has no political standing. It cannot even survive without having tanks in the cities. So what are we negotiating with if the Iranian people are dead certain that they will take this regime out?
Mm-hmm. Waleed, the president's drawn what he calls a red line. No more attacks on U.S. forces, no acceleration toward nuclear weapons. We've already been seeing limited strikes in response to Iran's provocations. Is this administration prepared to follow through with sustained military action if Iran keeps crossing the line here?
Raymond, I'm not concerned about the military capabilities of the United States. I mean, let's all remember that a few months ago, President Trump ordered the destruction of the sites, of the nuclear sites, in 3 hours. People have been talking about it since the Obama administration. We had so many conversations. He ended it in 3 hours. There is no nuclear power in Iran to negotiate about. What there is there in Iran is a machine, a killing machine, by the Khomeinist regime that has killed over 30,000 people. So the only negotiations I can imagine is to find a way, a diplomatic way of transfer of power from this regime, which is like the Third Reich, outside and negotiate with an interim government that would be led by the opposition inside and outside the country to replace him. I mean, that logic is so different from what the negotiators are trying to get to, or some of the Arab countries, including Qatar, are trying to convince us that this is the way, that the regime will only make few concessions and everything will go back to what it was. No, that's 30,000 people killed away.
Hmm. Ghazal, your own father was a hostage to this regime. He loved freedom. He spoke out. He paid the ultimate price. Tell me about Jimmy Sharmad, your father. And when you hear U.S. officials talk about diplomatic engagement, what goes through your mind?
Let me tell you real quick in a summary of who my father was. My father was born in Iran, raised in Germany, and then we're living in America for the last 20 years here as Americans. So from here, as a software engineer, he created a website for the people of Iran 20 years ago, before we had, you know, a phone with Twitter and everything on it and social media, where people in Iran could log in. Their IP addresses were protected. He was giving them VPNs before we even know what VPNs were. So giving them a tool to mobilize and take this regime down. How threatening is that to the Ayatollah regime? So threatening that in 2009, they sent assassins to Los Angeles, to our door where we live, to murder my father. And this was thankfully foiled by the FBI back then. But they didn't stop. So their terror continued until they were able to kidnap my father on a flight overlay in Dubai, drag him through two state borders to Iran, and hold him hostage for the last 5 years under the Biden administration, which did nothing to save their hostage. They didn't talk about him. To the contrary, they paid $1.2 billion per hostage to bring other hostages out and left him behind to be killed and murdered.
Awful. Just awful. I'm so sorry. Waleed, let's talk about the Christians and other religious minorities in Iran. We don't hear much about them in the mainstream press, but they're among the most persecuted communities in the world under this regime. How does the persecution of Christians fit into Iran's broader strategy of control? And what should the U.S. be doing to support these communities?
Well, Raymond, the regime has been persecuting all ethnicities, all groups in Iran. The minorities have suffered significantly. The regime has been oppressing the entire population, but the Christians have been singled out, have been persecuted, especially in the 90s. I remember where the head of the evangelical community was executed, persecuted, and of course, every other Middle Eastern Christians, should they be Assyrian, Armenian, and others, although the regime has been claiming, oh, we are protecting them. I remember the regime and Assad, both of them have been claiming, oh, we are protecting them. No, those minorities have barely the rights that a caliphate would give, like 1,400 years ago. But let's be very clear. For the Christians of Iran to feel safer, freer, the Iranian people as a whole will have to be free. Why? Because the Christians in Iran are not located in one place, like the Kurds or other. They are dispersed across the nation, and their fate is linked to the fate of the civil society in Iran.
Yeah. Ghazal, you've been in contact with dissidents inside Iran. People are risking everything during these uprisings. How many people has the regime actually done away with? And what are people telling you right now? Is there enough ground support, if you will, to overthrow this regime? And do they even have that in the sights at this moment?
A lot of questions. I think the most important was the last one that you asked. Is there enough ground support? So let me translate real quick what this regime or the Iranian people saw in the last 50 years. Imagine for 1 second the most anti-American politician that you can think of, be it like the mayor of New York right now, Ilhan Omar or Rashid, you know, whoever you think by policy is anti-American and a threat to what we stand for. On paper, they might be American, they might have an American passport, they might speak English. But imagine these kinds of people coming with an army of turbaned Arab Islamists to DC, taking over the White House, seizing power, then starting to lynch members of the House and the Senate, exile our president, exile our Secretary of State, then come and burn our American flag and replace it with an ISIS flag, then come and replace our national anthem with chants for Islamic prayer, and then come and rip up our constitution and replace it by Sharia law just to impose on the people of America Sharia law and lynch them for the next 50 years. What do you think the people of America would think about that? Do you think we will sit down and say, well, this is now a new government? Or do you think the people of America will rise up year after year, whatever the cost is, to say this is an occupation, this is not America, and we want these people out? That's what's happening in Iran for the last 50 years. So from the moment the Ayatollahs were flown into Iran, the Iranian people saw them as a threat and as an occupation, and have been rising again and again and again at great personal cost. As you said, 30,000 people were massacred within days, and they're continuing to do that. They have not stopped yet. So if you're willing to give life and limb to get your country back. What else can stop you? These people, we just saw new footage from Iran after this massacre. Schoolgirls are sitting in the school, massive chants, and saying, students, we as students will be killed, will die, but we will not sit down. That's the base ground, or what you're calling the forces on the ground that we have there. Millions of Iranians are ready to go.
Waleed, I'll leave with this. That groundswell that we're seeing now, is it sufficient to topple this regime? And if you were in the Situation Room right now with the president, you would tell him what about this Iranian regime's intentions?
If I have my 10, 15 minutes with the president in the Situation Room or in the White House in general, I would say, Mr. President, number one, you need to direct a speech, not just a tweet. The tweet was fantastic, the first one, the second, and all of these tweets, a long speech to the Iranian people. That is the equivalent of a huge military force, because he would mobilize, as Giselle said, millions and millions of Iranians. And we may need less, actually, actions if Iranians believe that the United States is coming. Number two, making sure that we will tell our allies, look, on this one, thank you, Gulf, thank you, Turkey, thank you, everybody. But that's a situation that we Americans are going to be dealing with the Iranian people, our allies. And you know why? The president will understand that, because he understands the capabilities and the resources of this magnificent, huge nation of 90 million people. They have a coast much longer than than any other coast of the Persian Gulf. They have all the gas that anybody in the world will dream of. So we are very close from creating a massive change in the region and in the world, if the president is convinced.
Well, we'll keep our eyes on it. We'll call upon you all again. Waleed, Giselle, thank you both for being here. Catch the War and Freedom podcast at War Freedom on YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A remarkable production is making its way from the Grotto of Lourdes to the stages of America. It's called Bernadette the Musical, and it's not your typical story about a saint. The director, a self-proclaimed non-believer, spent a decade trying to say no to this project. The producer's a Wall Street analyst who'd been to a musical exactly three times in his life, and the star, a young French girl, now 23, who's literally grown up in the role. Plus, Hollywood legend Kelsey Grammer has signed on as a co-lead producer. This unlikely team has fashioned something that's already captivated audiences across Europe. And now, the show is set for its U.S. premiere on February 19th in Chicago. I sat down recently with the director, a producer, and the star of the show to find out why Bernadette's story still matters.
Apparition miraculeuse, une jeune fille dit avant vu la vierge.
Serge Denoncourt is one of Canada's most celebrated directors. He's done everything from Annie to Hair, but when a French producer first approached him about directing a musical about Saint Bernadette, his answer was immediate.
Say, that will never happen. I'm not a believer. I was not interested. I did direct like 150 shows in my life, and I said, that won't be...
Not doing this.
No. And they insist a lot, and then they invite me in Lourdes. Didn't work.
You went to Lourdes, and what happened?
Yeah, didn't work. I was not convinced. And then I...
Not convinced of what?
That I should direct that show.
Okay.
And then I went with some scholars who knows everything about Bernadette, and I asked question, and they show me like a book written by the inspector, all the notes.
Who interrogated Bernadette.
Yeah, so you have the question and the answers, and in a bad French because they're not so educated.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated by Bernadette, who just said, no, you're wrong. He was saying, oh, you saw the Virgin Mary? No, I never said that. She was so tough and stubborn, and I said, I love that girl. And then I asked them, when did she say she saw the Virgin Mary? And there was a moment, and they said, she never said it. I said, okay, we have a show. There's a good story there.
Why did you think that was the linchpin?
For me, because if you have to direct a show about a saint that you already know
is
that
perfection.
She's a saint, what's the point? And the true story, because I'm all about the historical thing, is that she saw something, and I think she's not a liar. She saw something, some light, some voices. And she said, I don't know what it was. Hmm. So it was the Virgin Mary? I don't know. Why are you saying? Yes, but it should be the, I don't know. She was so honest. Mm-hmm. Because she could have said, yes, it's the Virgin Mary and I'm somebody so important. And mm-hmm. she didn't do that. So you think, okay, maybe she's crazy. Maybe she's sick. Maybe.
Yeah.
And then you have the spring, when she discovered the spring, which is a miracle.
Yeah.
And so whatever she saw, you say, oh, something happened there.
Pierre Ferragut is about as far from Broadway as you can get. He's a Wall Street analyst who sings only at Mass, off-key, I might add, but a chance encounter at a dinner party in France changed everything.
At a dinner party in France 3 years ago, I met someone who had a very nice sweatshirt with the face of Bernadette on his shoulders, and I asked him, where did you find your sweatshirt? I want to buy the same to my kids. And he told me the story that he actually helped produce a musical about the life of Bernadette. And we talked about it the whole night.
Wow.
And at the end of the evening, I told him, well, what you guys are doing is beautiful. I think it's a great way to very positively influence the culture. I love it. If there is anything I can do to help you, let me know. I live in New York. I'm a Wall Street guy.
Wow. How did Kelsey Grammer get involved?
I had been to a musical only 3 times in my life before I met these people.
So really?
I had really no interest in the musical, but...
Never
produced anything before.
Wow.
So I said yes, but I wasn't too sure what to do. And at some point, I ended up talking about it to my spiritual director, uh-huh. Father Marc Edu. And I told him, you know, I have this situation where people have asked me to help them. I think the right thing to do is to help them, but I have no idea what to do. And Father Mark said, well, you know, I'm a priest, so I don't know either. And I was like, well, thanks for your help.
Yeah.
But then he said, well, you know, I met Kelsey Grammer a few years ago in Rome, and I think I still have his phone number. Do you want to call him? And so we called Kelsey together. And Kelsey, I sent a video of the French show with English subtitles to mm-hmm. Kelsey, and Kelsey immediately said, how can I help? Huh. And then we came to like share, you know, the burden of the production.
What is the message here, and what do you hope people of faith, Catholics and others, will get from this production?
As a kid, growing up in France in a Catholic family, my dad is a member of the Order of Malta, so Lourdes was really part of my life. I went there as a child, and I was really touched by the spirituality of the place, the experience with like sick people, older people going to Lourdes for healing, and the notion of spiritual healing. But the one thing that really didn't interest me was the story of the little girl. She was like poor, didn't even go to school, she got bullied, she was very sick, very fragile health, she died very young. Mm-hmm. She went straight into a convent after the events, so it was really not appealing. And then I watched this show in Paris, and I realized the little girl was actually an amazing girl. She was like a real teenager. She reminded me my number four, who was at the time 14 years old, and her relationship with her dad and with her mom, her attitude towards like the priest, towards the police. She was like a fantastic, fantastic personality. And she had, you know, she was really a little girl. So she wasn't a saint, like Serge, the director, likes to say. She wasn't made a saint yet. She was like a very normal girl with an exceptional fate.
Emma was just 14 years old when Serge first met her at her home in France. She knew nothing about Saint Bernadette, nothing about Lourdes, and she certainly didn't think she was going to spend the next 8 years of her life playing the role. Tell me about Emma, who you cast as Bernadette.
Yeah.
Why her? What did you see?
So, because it was so obvious. She was 14 when I met her.
Hmm.
She was 14, and I was at her home, and people say, maybe you can find your Bernadette there. I didn't do an audition. I talked with her and I said, sing me something. And she was at the table, 14, very shy. Too shy to be an actress. Hmm. And I said, that's the one I want.
She had that quality that Bernadette would have, that reticence.
And it was great because I just tell her the story and she felt in love with the character as a 14 years old girl. Hmm. She thought that Bernadette was amazing. So she's still on the show because she looks young.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to have her with me.
Serge mentioned that you're not a believer when you came to this. You weren't raised Catholic.
I thought that there were a lot of pop, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that there was just one pope.
Oh.
At the beginning, because...
Oh, you thought there were many popes.
Yes, why not?
What did you come to realize about this girl in playing her? How long have you been playing the role?
I started when I was 15. I'm 23 now.
What have you learned from playing Bernadette?
Since I'm on this cast in Lourdes, I learned the simplicity. Lourdes, it's a big city of hope, love, and I like to be with people and to share just the story of Bernadette. And I like the character of Bernadette.
What do you like about her?
She is like a girl like me, like other girls, and she's... she fights for her ideas.
Hmm.
And I love.
She fights for what she saw and the truth that she encountered.
She fights for the truth. Huh. Yes. It's so interesting.
Has it changed you at all, playing the role?
Yes.
As a person?
Of course. I started when I was a kid, a little girl, mm-hmm. like Bernadette. Yeah. And I grew up with this role, so everything is like changing with me, and yes.
Do you believe Bernadette and her vision personally?
I think that she saw something. Mm. Like she said in the show, it's something nobody knows.
And what did she say? She saw a lady in light?
She saw a lady dressed in white.
When you're down on your knees, so just go on your way, and your back's to the wall, and leave while you can.
What's remarkable about Bernadette the musical is how it's transcended the obvious audience. This isn't just playing to Catholic pilgrims in Lourdes.
It's one of the most complicated show I have to talk about, because the believer, they believe, they love this show. They just love it. They come to see the show, they are ecstatic. The non-believer, we have to convince them to come. Just to say, it's just a good show. If you're interested by history, what happened in France at that time. So they come, and they finally love the show. Because I tell the story of that little girl before she became a saint.
Is that a lot of media, secular media, came to watch the show with kind of like probably like a negative angle and came back with very, very positive reviews. And reviews were about, it's a story about girl power. It's a story about a teenager being bullied on Instagram. It's a story of a 14 years old girl and her dad and the difficult love between a dad and a 14 years old. And all these stories really generated, I can't remember a single negative or mixed review. All reviews were very positive, even from the most like anti-clerical, anti-religious press. And then that actually attracted, I think, a lot of the Catholic audience.
What do you want young women who come to see the show, what do you want them to take from your performance and the character of Bernadette?
Just to follow their ideas, their opinions, to stay ourselves.
To be true to yourself.
Yes.
To be true to yourself.
Yes.
Bernadette the Musical premieres on February 19th with previews starting February 12th. at the Athenaeum Center in Chicago, Illinois. And then it begins its national run across the U.S. For tickets and showtimes in Chicago and all the other stops, visit BernadetteTheMusical.com. And be sure to join us next week, February 12th. I'll have my conversation with co-producer of Bernadette, Hollywood legend Kelsey Grammer. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to follow us on social media. Until next week, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.